You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Wisconsin Wakes Up Here. Back to Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:06 right now. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on the Civic Media Network. We hope that you are having a wonderful Tuesday. A little light rain and some drizzle on and off here in Madison. Hopefully you're seeing some sunshine wherever you're at. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Yesterday, the president came out to talk to us, but once again, he failed to present a logical or urgent rationale for the military campaign, or do you call it war? I'm going to say war in Iran. Only 37% of Americans approve of Trump's foreign policy. 70% believe the president should consult Congress on matters of war. Iran has already said they will not continue to negotiate with the U.S. So have the president's unilateral decisions both here and abroad put America's power at risk? Allison McManus is the managing director for of National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. She joins us now. Allison, good morning. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. I wish we were to discuss something more positive, but here we are.
Yeah, this is the hand we've been dealt. You guys at the Center for American Progress have been running a Trump global weakness watch, reviewing the president's global foreign policy decisions. I looked at it today and it was shocking, but what have you found?
Well, what we've found, Brian, is that the president has had a penchant for using American power. And let's be, you know, honest and real here. We are the strongest military and economic power in the world, in a world of rising middle powers like China and others. But we have significant power. What we found is that the way that Trump has been using that power has been eroding it, has been weakening it. He is using that power unilaterally, and by unilaterally, I mean without the consent of Congress, and therefore without the consent of the American people. We've seen that in terms of military action, for instance, in Venezuela, and this war, and I will say war, with Iran is the latest, and I would say most egregious example. We've also seen it in the way that he has pursued tariffs, which of course the Supreme Court struck down recently. And I also say unilateral in that this is the United States often going it alone, not just going it alone, but going it in ways that antagonize our closest partners and allies. That just doesn't make the United States stronger. It actually weakens our power, weakens our ability to pursue, you know, the interests that really matter to people in Wisconsin, people all over the country in the process.
Is this a break, Allison, from the America First message that Trump and the administration likes to tout, or does this administration argue that what's happening right now in the Middle East still fits, or even in Venezuela, does it still fit that America First framework?
You know, Jamie, I have given up trying to theorize and make sense of the Trump administration's foreign policy, domestic policy. You know, they tend to say one thing and then do something else. I mean, to the extent that we could say America First was meant to be focusing, you know, this is what Trump said on the campaign trail, focusing on issues that matter to Americans at home, focusing on affordability, he made a promise, not pursuing foreign wars. This is the absolute and complete reversal of that. Now, I don't necessarily agree with the premise of America First to begin with. I think that the way we actually deliver for Americans, the way we ensure and protect the American way of life is by having a smart foreign policy that works with partners and allies. It doesn't mean just, you know, retrenching, isolating, and turning inwards. What we're seeing here is, you know, none of the above. We are looking at the costs right now of this military operation. In only 2 days, we are seeing multi-billions of dollars being spent. The Congress appropriates funds for the Pentagon for defense. Not for senseless wars without the consent of Congress. And the other, you know, aspect here that I would note is We are looking at these energy markets that are all over the place already. The longer that this goes on, it's, you know, not just that we're spending taxpayer dollars in ways that many taxpayers wouldn't agree with. It's this is going to actually raise costs for Americans as this war continues. And of course, you know, I also need to mention we have lost six American service members, and you know, you cannot put a price on the value of a human life, on the value of our troops. And so, no, it's very hard to say this is America first in any way.
Allison McManus is our guest. She's Managing Director of National Security International Policy for the Center for American Progress. Allison, let's go back to where we started for a minute, the concept of strength, because this administration equates strength just with military might. When Center for American Progress talks about strength, it's not just military might, is it? Because we do have a great military, but that's not everything.
Absolutely, Brian. I think when we talk about strength, when we talk about American power, we want to talk about the tools that we have in our toolbox. And we also want to think about what is the point of having this power? Again, having this power isn't just to exercise it on a whim or to achieve narrow interests, you know, of any particular president. This power should be built and utilized in the best interests of the American people. And what do the American people care about? Well, we care about, you know, pursuit of economic opportunities, the protection of our freedoms and liberties. And so when we look at the, you know, actions like removing the, you know, president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, brutal dictator that he was, or killing Iran's supreme leader, Khamenei, again, brutal dictator that he was, we have to ask, you know, how is this necessarily delivering for the American people? And we also have to ask, what other tools might we have in our power toolbox to be able to achieve those interests? And so again, you know, we could potentially agree that we do want to see a world that is more stable. We don't necessarily want to see a world that's run by brutal dictators. We certainly don't want to see a world in which Iran achieves a nuclear weapon. But, you know, I think that we have seen plenty of times over the past decades where those ends can be achieved much more effectively and deliver much more effectively and frankly, with more cost efficacy by using, for instance, diplomatic tools, economic tools, or others. Military force should only be a last resort.
Now, over at AmericanProgress.org, you've written, Allison, about how this unpredictability actually weakens the U.S. power. So does launching strikes during ongoing diplomatic talks actually damage America's credibility going forward, not only in the Middle East conflict, but to other nations across the world?
Absolutely. And I think we have to question, you know, the genuine interest and or the capacity of the negotiators to have actually reached a deal. I mean, what we are seeing now, you know, really makes me question whether those negotiators, you know, were even actually interested or whether they were just going through the motions in trying to reach a deal in order to say, you know, that they tried, but really were more interested in either just extracting, you know, total and unrealistic concessions or using military force. So I wanted to say that up front. To the extent that they were actually interested in diplomacy and diplomatic means to reaching a deal, I mean, we can hardly say that they had exhausted all of those options. And so it does, I think, leave other countries with the feeling that they are, one, not going to be able to trust the United States as a reliable partner, not even just partner, but interlocutor. And again, I think we saw this with the tariffs, moving goalposts constantly, doing deals and then reneging on them. And two, you know, the other piece of this that really frightens me is that, you know, I worry that there is now a greater incentive. We obviously have, you know, very early in this war. We don't know where the dust is going to settle or what leadership is going to look like in Iran. But I really worry that they have actually raised the incentive for Iran to pursue a nuclear weapon at this point, because the Iranians now can no longer trust that reaching some kind of diplomatic deal makes sense, and may feel like the only option they have for defense is a nuclear option, and that may unlock a new nuclear arms race across the Middle East and potentially increase penchant for nuclear weaponization in the world.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Allison, because it doesn't seem like Israel and the U.S. thought outside of just Iran. The attacks were on Iran, but now in the only a couple days, the entire region is caught up in this. The United Nations is having to weigh in. In your experience with that area of the world, and I know the Middle East is a quagmire, so it's not easy to make any kind of predictions. Where do you think the region is going to start to fall as this goes into the third, fourth, fifth day, maybe, and we don't know how many weeks, neither does the president, so...
Well, we saw immediately, I mean, there's a couple things here. We saw immediately that, you know, the Gulf countries who have typically been partners, even, you know, in intercepting, blocking Iranian missiles, they have no strong love for the Islamic Republic, came out and condemned the strikes initially. And so again, this was not, you know, we would typically like to see, if we are going to war, not just, of course, consent of Congress, but also, coordination with our partners. Now that the Iranians are attacking energy infrastructure, tourism infrastructure, airports, et cetera, in the Gulf, that may change the dynamics. It may actually draw some of those Gulf countries and others into this war. We're seeing the same dynamics in Europe, strong condemnation at first, but now that the Iranians have really widened, the scope of their attacks to try and inflict damage on U.S. partners, it may broaden this war and draw other nations in as well.
But wouldn't other countries look at this? And it's almost like, to go back to the strength perception, we started this. We're the ones who hit the hornet's nest. So, yes, they can come out and condemn Iran now because they're attacking all these other infrastructure places. But their ire has to still be pointed at the U.S. and Israel because this was on us.
Absolutely. But, you know, I think two things could be true at once.
Correct.
I do think that the Iranians, you know, the intention of targeting this infrastructure is to try to pressure U.S. partners to go to Trump and say, cut it out, let's dial down the temperature. Mm-hmm. At the same time, if the United States or Israel continues with attacks, or if the Iranians continue with retaliation, they may be left, frankly, with no choice. They can't just sit there and beg President Trump, please stop, right, so that the Iranians will stop attacking us.
Allison, we have about a minute left, but I think for people listening at home, 6,000 miles away from Iran, what do you think, is there a direct threat to the United States right now at home?
The direct threat that I would be most worried about, again, is twofold. One, it's the cost to our military. My husband is a former naval flight officer. We have military families all over this country. Many of them are very anxious. And then I'd be worried about the costs to our pocketbooks as energy prices continue to increase.
Perfect. Well, Allison, we appreciate your time this morning. Allison McManus is Managing Director of National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. Go to AmericanProgress.org to get more information. Allison, have a great day. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Brian. Thanks, Jamie. Take care.
It's 8:19. I'm sorry, 8:19, Daybreak on the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Now back to more of Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning on the Civic Media Network. It is 8:22. This is Daybreak. I'm Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Glad you're here. If you want to get involved, give us a call, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. You can text that number, too. I know people don't like talking on the phone anymore. It's a,
it's a weird thing. I hate it.
I know. Well, you're in that generation.
You are. Yeah.
Anytime, my daughter complains that I never call her. But every time I call her, I just leave a message because she refuses to,
pick up her phone.
She will FaceTime and she will text, but she won't. She won't call on the phone.
I don't know. I'm older, much older than that generation, and there are days when I'm like, do I really? Just voicemail. I'll deal with it later or text you later.
You know, I text and I'll leave a voicemail, but I don't mind. If it's a friend of mine or if I know it's something important, I would much rather, it's easier for me to talk about it on the phone.
Depends on the person.
Depends on the person and the situation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like if there was something complicated I needed to tell Parker, like why he needs to play Barry Manilow and why his objections to playing Barry Manilow are not conducive
Mandy,
to the show
Culpa
being a
Cabana,
success.
These are all really good songs, by the way. Just
right.
Then I would
call him.
Yes.
Because I don't want any of my emotion to be lost in a text.
That's true. Get you. That makes total sense. Yes.
But if it's like, hey, we got a Trump clip, I'll email it. I'll text it to you. That's true. Yeah.
We've all been there. We've all done that at some point during the day, especially doing what we do.
All right. Well, doing what we do involves looking around the state, and we've been covering this for a while. The Chippewa Valley has become a, I don't want to say hotbed, but more and more ice activity has been happening in the Chippewa Valley. And three more counties, Dunn, Green Lake, and Walworth County, their law enforcement has all signed agreements with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or if you know them better, as ICE. I want to know what you think about this. ICE actually coming into Wisconsin now, and while There have been little activities in Milwaukee, no big occupation. There's activities, especially in rural communities where ICE is targeting agricultural workers. What do you think of this when you hear local law enforcement is signing agreements saying, yes, we are going to help ICE? The agreements are part of a program which allows law enforcement to help enforce federal immigration laws. Your thoughts on that, 855-756-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. I don't know where the 6 came from. 6-7, maybe?
Maybe. With this particular program, it's called ICE's 287G program, just for technical terms.
Sure.
It's under the warrant service officer model they chose. County deputies can actually arrest people who are already targeted by ICE through administrative immigration warrants. There's already been a lot of discussions about the administrative versus the judicial warrants when it comes to ICE and what those actually mean and what they're able to do with said warrants. Now, Dunn County's agreement was signed on February 10th. The Green Lake and Walworth agreements are still pending final approval. And with these additions, 19 out of Wisconsin's 72 counties now participate in this 287G program. Most Wisconsin counties in the program use the warrant service model. Kenosha and Marathon counties use the jail enforcement model that actually allows deputies to notify ICE about undocumented immigrants being held in county jails. Then you have Kewaunee, Sauk, and Waukesha counties that participate in both models. Dodge County does not formally participate in 287G. It had this long, it had a long contract to house federal immigration detainees in its jails, though. Now, if you're a supporter of all of these agreements, you say that they help local law enforcement cooperate with the federal authorities and also remove individuals who are in the county unlawfully. Of course, then you have the critics on one side who say that this is it basically creates fear in the immigrant communities. The ACLU of Wisconsin has weighed in, saying that these types of partnerships discourage people, even if they have a legal status, from reporting crimes or even cooperating with police when they need to or are asked in certain circumstances. And you can't really argue with that. If you have an emergency and you're scared because you are of a certain skin color right. or a certain descent, right? You're not going to want to call. You're not going to want to have somebody knocking at your door because of these types of programs.
No, and Lynn is in Golden Valley. She texts in. You can too, 855-75-CIVIC. I would just remind local sheriffs, she says, they are easy to sue for ICE bad behavior. Feds are nearly impossible to sue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it goes back to if the target of these raids were truly just the worst of the worst, I have no problem if you're arrested in Dodge County.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheriff runs your identity, and they find out this guy is, one, undocumented, two, he's wanted for murder, he's wanted for gang activity, he's wanted for drug trafficking, whatever. Okay, then you call. But to have an agreement where you have to call every time. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
if an undocumented farm worker jaywalks or gets
right.
a parking ticket or a speeding ticket or you know, comes out of a bar drunk and is walking down the street and gets stopped. Is that really necessary? Do I want my local police doing it?
It's erosion yes. of trust in the community. And let's be realistic. Sheriffs are elected officials. So these agreements are essentially policy choices that shape how law enforcement mm-hmm. operates in particular counties. And if you are someone afraid to call because it might lead to questions about your immigration status, you're just not going to call. So now you're affecting victims. You're possibly affecting witnesses who are worried about being flagged and because they have to remain silent. That's going to affect entire neighborhoods, not just undocumented residents. That affects the entire community.
Law enforcement already has a public perception problem.
Of course.
This is going to cement that even more. Well, it's time to take another break, Jamie, because big commerce is on our backs. This is Daybreak. I'm Brian Noonan.
I'm Jamie Martinson. You are listening to the Civic Media Network.
Local voices, statewide impact. It's Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:35 right now. You are listening to the Civic Media Network. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And good morning, I'm Brian Noonan. Reports of ICE activity in the Chippewa Valley have been increasing since the beginning of the year. After four people in Altoona were detained, a protest was held outside the Altoona Police Department. Lalo Licon is with us. He is a community activist and a member of the group El Centro de Conexión de Chippewa Valley. He's here to talk about that. Lalo, thanks for being here this morning. We appreciate it. Talk about the incident in Altoona and why the Eau Claire Sheriff's account of the incident differs from the account of not only the people who were detained, but everybody who witnessed this.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you for having me. Well, there's a number of things with regard to whether the homeowner was intending to shelter the people or whether they had essentially broken into the place and then the homeowner gave permission allegedly to the police to go in there and force them out. There's also the whole premise for the police getting involved. And that was ICE apparently telling local police that they were looking for someone who had assaulted an officer. And so then that gave the police, Altoona Police Department, and then the fact that they were in the town of Washington, not technically Eau Claire or Altoona, allowed them to call and get assistance from the Eau Claire Sheriff's Department. And so, yeah, the whole premise that they were there to find someone who had assaulted an officer, I think it just falls in line with what we've seen throughout the country with ICE lying to people when they knock on their door, lying to people when they pull them over, and then lying to the press and apparently even to the police to get them to back them up on what they're trying to get done.
Now, El Centro de Conexión is asking for the body cam footage for more transparency that the Altoona police were wearing. There are reports that that will be released later this week. What specifically, as a member of this group, are you hoping that this footage is going to show, Lalo?
We're just trying to we just want the truth to be out, that the story that was released in the media was released completely in line with what the police told them. And so we just want the truth to be out there. And yeah.
Well, part of the truth is in question because people who witnessed the event told the press, hey, you know, we're parents at the Altoona Elementary School, and this was happening right down the block, and we were very, very nervous about it, the whole thing. And yet the superintendent is like, no, we didn't, there was no problems at the school. So where's the truth in that part of the story? I mean, this is the issue, and I get why you guys want the body cameras, because this, they said, I said, we mm-hmm. said, nobody's mm-hmm. getting to the truth. Was there any mm-hmm. incident with the school?
No, not that I know of. A direct incident with the school. With that said, there doesn't have to be a direct incident with
Correct.
The school.
Mm-hmm.
Our community has been in fear, especially since the first week of January. We've been very aware of ICE presence in our area. And so people have been very nervous. There's been too many rumors circulating all the time. People are just in constant fear. And we've seen this in the business owners complaining about business going down. We've seen this in the elementary schools where there's been days when more than half the children are absent. It's just been a very clear state of fear this year.
We're talking with Lalo Lee Cohn. He is a member of the advocacy group El Centro de Conexión de Chippewa Valley. Now, if this body cam footage is actually released of this incident that took place in Altoona on February 17th, and if it confirms the sheriff's version of events, what happens next? And if it does contradict the version that has been in the press, what does your group feel like accountability should look like at that point?
Yeah, I think it'll be in the local press. Just an acknowledgement of how the account of things did not fit what was instantly released at the moment.
Let's go back to what you said about rumors, because there were big stories in Milwaukee a month or so ago about fake rumors being circulated, whether it was by people in the media or not. So, one, where are the rumors coming from that are affecting your community, and what is El Centro de Conexión de Chippewa Valley doing to combat those rumors?
Yeah, part of that is just, you know, comes with the presence. You know, it's seeing the ICE vehicles in town in itself leads people to say ICE is in this place, ICE is in that place. But it doesn't mean that they are actively arresting people or that they're going around pulling people over. And so we've had to try to better organize ourselves as a community and work together with all as many interested parties as possible so that we can verify information before we continue circulating rumors, so that as soon as we can debunk rumors, we start doing that.
Now, you have said that this isn't abstract anymore. It's happening in your community. What do you mean by that, and how has daily life changed for families in the Chippewa Valley since January?
Yeah. Well, like I said, people at times refrain from taking their children to school. People refrain from going to work. People refrain from getting out of their house whenever it is not absolutely necessary. People have had to ask for assistance with even just rides to church, rides to the grocery store, rides for their kids to school, taking as many precautions as possible so that their kids aren't left without their parents.
Lala, we were just talking before you joined us about three more counties in Wisconsin that are signed agreements to cooperate with ICE. When you hear that, what do you think the people in your community and what does the organization think about this, and what can you do to maybe change their mind? Because some of these agreements haven't been finalized yet, so there's still a chance to change them.
You know, again, it just increases fear. It's just people increasingly feeling like you cannot trust the police. Instead of going to the police whenever you want to report a crime, instead people will refrain from doing that because they don't know if the police are going to help them or arrest them and separate them from their family instead.
For people who are listening today outside of the Chippewa Valley, why should they care, Lalo, about what's happening in Eau Claire, Altoona, and in your area of the state right now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is happening in many places. It certainly isn't just here. But there's a lot of things from just our the civil rights, the Bill of Rights for Americans, you know, just, you know, people getting detained without due process, you know, the U.S. fundamental rights are being violated throughout the country. So that should matter for everyone. Now, in Wisconsin, Latinos have been the largest minority for a while. Immigrants make up something like 70% of dairy workers in the state. And we know that the dairy industry is very important to Wisconsin identity. Well, without those immigrant workers, we would lose that important aspect of our identity to the state. Without them, either the cost of dairy and dairy products would triple or quadruple, or they'd have to leave where they can be more competitive, probably abroad.
Yeah, absolutely. Lalo Lacone, he is a member of the advocacy group El Centro de Conexión de Chippewa Valley. We appreciate you being with us this morning and sharing what's happening in the western part of the state for so many of us that aren't actually seeing some of the ICE presence right now. Again, thank you for your time. And
thank you, Lalo.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Brian, I think, you know, as Lalo basically pointed out, what one of the things that we're forgetting is how important these immigrant communities are to to not just the big cities, right? Because Yeah, I mean, so far we've seen the ICE presence in major metropolitan areas like Minneapolis. We've seen it in Portland. We've seen it in Chicago. We've seen it in L.A. But sometimes these immigrant communities are even more important to your rural communities because they own businesses, do the work like Lalo was pointing out.
All you have to do is ask any big farmer, any farmer in these remote areas. The problem is we don't hear about those actions because there's not a lot of media coverage. If you own a farm somewhere in a small rural community, the media isn't coming to follow, you know, one or two ICE vehicles to your farm. But when all of a sudden part of your workforce is too afraid to come to work, and boy, can we start a list of sentences I'm tired of saying? Everybody can agree that the immigration system needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
All right. We get that. But at this point, there are a lot of people who depend on those workers who are coming here. They're paying taxes. They're working hard. And we've made the process of becoming a citizen very, very difficult.
We have.
And not that it should be a walk in the park, but it shouldn't be so prohibitive that it's better to try to live in the shadows for your whole life.
And I think when it comes to this story that Lalo was talking about in Altoona, it's going to be interesting when that body cam footage is released, because there are so many contradictory versions of what happened on February 17th.
Right.
From the homeowner to the police to the actual people who were arrested. There's a lot of different versions. So I think it's going to be important to keep it all into context. And here's the thing I would say. I'm going to be of the opinion that I don't like our local sheriff's departments partnering with ICE, not especially right now.
Not especially with
what's happening in the world. And I feel like, you know, we were talking at the break, a lot of our sheriff's departments are understaffed. They are under budgeted. And now we're asking them to basically do yet another job when their job is basically to protect the communities that they serve.
And your point before is well taken, that sheriff is an elected position. So these are people that were elected, and they may be co-opting their representative's mindset, or maybe they're going against what their representative usually votes for.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, you have enough to worry about as a local law enforcement officer that you don't need, let the feds do the feds, let local do local, and never the twain shall mix.
That's right. So. It's 8:48 right now. You are listening to the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Wisconsin Wakes Up Here. Back to Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:52 right now. Pulling out the Barry Manilow finally for us. Thank you so much, Parker.
I know you needed it.
You've been
begging all day.
We have.
We have. Because, listen, why stop now? We're bringing out the big news, the heavy news, the happy news. Thanks again to Lalo Lacombe for giving us an on-street level of what's happening in the Chippewa Valley. So that's, you know, it's important, but it doesn't make you feel the greatest. And that's, you know, that's all right. Here's something, boy, oh boy, oh boy. Jamie, the bird flu, it's been detected in a poultry flock owned by Daybreak Foods, no relation to the program. we don't contribute to bird flu. We are not fans of bird flu. This is in Jefferson County. Third time in 6 months that the virus has been found in their birds. That's according to the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture. Bird flu back in a big, big way in Wisconsin. So not good news if you are a poultry farmer.
Yeah. The facility that we're talking about is located in the town of Palmyra in between Madison and Milwaukee. And it's actually been quarantined to limit movement of poultry products, and birds on the farm will be killed to prevent the spread of the disease. Now, the same location was released from quarantine in November after bird flu was reported twice last fall in the company's Jefferson County flocks. One of those flocks then had more than 3 million birds. The flock with the latest detection has about 1.2 million birds. Now,
this is something where I like to ask the experts. So if you are a poultry farmer, please call in and explain how this happens. If you've been affected, or if one of your neighbors, somebody that you know, because I don't understand how, one, the H1N1 becomes live in the flock.
Right.
And then what do you do if you have to kill 3 million birds?
Yeah, that's not a small number of birds, is it? And it feels like for...
No, to answer your question, no.
No,
3 million is not a small number.
No, I can't even... I'm terrified of birds, so let me be realistic. This is a frightening story for me on multiple levels.
Only if we had some sick chickens in there, I would worry about you. Right now, we're just talking.
You're
in a safe place, Jamie. You're okay. Parker, keep the chickens out of the studio. Call off my prank.
Don't worry.
Call it off.
The chickens are out.
Okay,
don't worry about
chickens. Abort.
So the H5N1 bird flu virus has continued to spread across the United States over the last several years, and it's affected not only wild and domestic birds, but it's also affected dairy cattle, cats, elephant seals, and other mammals as well.
How many elephant seals are in Wisconsin?
I don't. Well, I suppose other parts of the country, though. You know,
you're sure other parts of the country,
right?
Yeah. What are they around the isthmus?
So not that I've seen recently.
All right, so, I didn't see them.
So the risk of people in the general public contracting bird flu remains pretty low, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Those at the
greatest... Yeah, but Robert F. Kennedy's involved there. Do you believe that?
I was just going to say.
Yeah.
Those are at the greatest risk are farm workers and others who come in close contact with infected birds or other animals. Now, but this leads to a bigger question. I mean, if you're talking about 3 million birds, or even in this case, 1.2 million birds that need to be potentially killed off, what does that do for the price of our chicken? And, oh, God, I hate to say it, but what about
don't
the price
eggs.
Of...
Don't say eggs.
I'm going to have to. I have to in this case. What about the price of eggs?
Oh, boy.
I mean, because let's be realistic. During the 2024 presidential campaign, when Donald Trump talked about the price of eggs, it was because there was a bird flu epidemic running
yes.
rampantly across the country, killing multiple flocks of millions of birds.
But that was that part was never mentioned. It was Joe Biden was driving up the price of eggs.
It should have been
because everybody who followed any sort of news was hearing about
right.
this and the fact that these chickens were having to be put down. I'm trying to say humanely. They had to kill a bunch of chickens.
They did.
So that's just the way it is. Listen, Jamie, that's how it goes. Sometimes when you got to age what I want, you just got to, they just
yes.
die. There's deaths. There's going to be some
happens.
Deaths. It's okay. Chickens got
to
die.
But when this happens, I mean, you have to think about the supply chain, right? Because
mm-hmm.
the supply drops, so the prices are going to change. Families notice that at the grocery stores. Restaurants are going to notice it. Small bakeries are going to notice. And it also leads the bigger question is, why does this keep happening at these large-scale operations?
Exactly. Well, that's why I want to know
yeah.
how I'd like to get somebody. Well, I'm going to program. We're going to have a show meeting on the air. Frank, maybe somebody from the Department of Agriculture
yes.
to come on, because I want to know how this becomes a thing, and especially, like Jamie just said, repeatedly, if this farm, Daybreak Foods, has had this problem before.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, you don't blame a business because your animal gets sick, but how does the virus take hold? How does it then spread so quickly? And then the results for the farmers. This is...
And if we keep seeing this headline over and over, and we have to keep continually talking about the potential price of eggs, at some point, I think it's fair to ask, are we as a country adapting fast enough, or are we just continually bracing for the next round? Because that's what it feels like we're doing when we're talking about like these Daybreak Farms who have had, mm-hmm. this is their second round of bird flu since November. Right.
Yeah.
So are we adapting fast enough to actually make a dent or make a difference or do what we need to protect our food supply chain, too?
Yeah. And you're talking about the whole country. You're not just
yes.
singling out this.
No.
Because it is happening everywhere. And listen, pour one out for the seals, the elephant seals that
right?
somewhere are getting sick, too. We don't want that.
No, we don't want elephant
do
seals
no.
to get sick. No, absolutely
right.
not. I would kind of like 3 million chickens to not get sick. And I'm not a fan of birds, but I think that they deserve better than, you know, bird flu every couple of months.
Well, listen, if nothing else, just for the people whose livelihoods depend
yes.
on those chickens not being sick and not having to be killed for nothing, this is the way it goes. Oh, is that sad chicken music, or is that time for us to start wrapping up? It's time for
oh.
us to start wrapping up.
It's time
but
to start
Parker plays tear-jerking chicken music.
Copacabana. Oh, God, I'm so excited.
Oh, it's Copacabana.
Wow.
So excited. It is.
That's the hottest spot north of Havana.
It's Lola.
Music, passion, always in fashion at
her
the
Copa.
Her name
was Lola. She was a showgirl, after all.
She was. She wore a feather in her hair and a dress. Cut down to there. What would she do? Merengue, the cha-cha. We have 9 seconds. Wrap it up, Jamie.
8:59, the Civic Media Network. Thank you for joining us today.
Bye.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.